From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, an acting lesson from William H. Macy. He'll also perform a very short play by David Mamet. Macy and Mamet co-founded the Atlantic Theater Company. They also developed a new acting technique. For the first time ever, a video game has been adapted into a film. That film, Super Mario Brothers, opened today. We'll talk with journalist David Sheff, author of the new book, Game Over, How Nintendo Zapped an American Industry, Captured Your Dollars, and Enslaved Your Children. And David Bianculli previews a new TV series by the creator of The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton traveled to Philadelphia today to build on the momentum of his victory in the House of Representatives and to appeal for help in getting his budget bill through the Senate. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president addressed a large lunchtime crowd at City Hall in Philadelphia today, claiming that the vote in the House last night proved that he was beginning to deliver on his campaign promise of economic revitalization.
We are now moving forward with a plan that reduces the deficit, ask the wealthy who could play their fair share, gives the middle class the chance of having a future with real economic growth, and provides profound incentives to prefer work over welfare.
The White House is busy negotiating with moderate Democrats in the Senate from farm and oil states who object to the president's proposed energy tax and want him to make deeper cuts in spending. Mr. Clinton told the crowd today to take a look at the energy tax and decide for themselves if it was worth it. He claimed it would cost a family of four only $17 a month. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
Police in Miami have reported scattered incidents of rock and bottle throwing in two predominantly black neighborhoods. The incidents follow the acquittal of Miami police officer Joseph Lozano, who was charged with manslaughter in the shooting death of a black motorcyclist and the death of his passenger in the crash that followed. Lozano was retried on the charges after an appeals court ruled that a previous conviction was influenced by the possibility of riots. The shooting touched off 3 days of rioting in Miami in 1989. Miami police are out in force to deal with any potential violence. Hundreds of thousands of Italians have taken part in rallies today to protest a car bomb attack that killed 5 people and injured 50 yesterday. The blast also damaged the famous Uffizi Gallery. Francis Kennedy reports from Rome.
The biggest demonstration was in Florence itself, but large numbers also turned out in Milan and Rome. The Italian Interior Minister, Nicola Mancino, said the Uffizi bomb and one in Rome earlier this month were the work of the mafia. However, many people believe the mafia was not acting alone, but with the support of people who want to stop the huge corruption inquiry and the important process of electoral reform. There's fear here of a return to what's known as the strategy of tension in the 70s and early 80s, when a series of bomb attacks killed nearly 150 people. Meanwhile, the government has announced $20 million of emergency funds to repair the Uffizi Gallery. For National Public Radio, I'm Francis Kennedy in Rome.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 27 points to close at 3,527. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 4 points at 700.5. This is NPR News. President Clinton renewed favorable trade status today for China, but he said it's the last time unless China shows improvements on human rights, policy in Tibet, and other areas. The order extends China's most favored nation trade status for another year. After that, the Secretary of State will have to decide whether China has made progress in such areas as treatment of political prisoners and the use of prison labor. 5 of the 7 suspects in the World Trade Center bombing appeared together at a hearing in federal court in Manhattan today, where they pleaded not guilty to a series of new charges connected to the incident. Lawyers for 2 of the suspects complained at the hearing that news leaks in the case were jeopardizing their client's right to a fair trial. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Lawyer Michael Warshaw, who represents Bilal al-Qaizi, complained that investigators were trying to turn public opinion against the suspects by leaking information to the media. Recently, he said details of an FBI lab report appeared in the newspapers before he had even seen it.
We didn't do it, but the United States government, through some sources, have leaked every single bit of information that you read in the newspapers now. It's disgusting.
Warshaw said some of the information the press has used has been wrong, but was difficult to respond to because it was provided anonymously. Federal Judge Kevin Duffy imposed a strict gag order on the participants in the case earlier this year, but it was later overturned by an appellate court. Duffy said today he could do nothing to stop the leaks and noted that some defense lawyers were also leaking information. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Coast Guard officials in New Orleans say that one person was killed today when a four-lane bridge collapsed just before the afternoon rush hour. They said the bridge was struck by a barge that knocked out a 200-foot segment and toppled two cars that fell into the barge and the bank of the city's industrial canal. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're about to hear a performance of David Mamet's shortest play. Okay, I don't know for sure it's his shortest, but cut me a break. It's only 2 minutes and 6 seconds long. It's one of several very short plays that will be performed June 7th at the annual benefit for the Atlantic Theatre Company in New York. The company was co-founded by a small group of artists, including David Mamet and my guest, William H. Macy. The company practices an acting technique developed by Macy and Mamet. Macy has both performed in and directed works by David Mamet. He starred in the off-Broadway hit Oleana and co-starred with Joe Mantegna in the film Homicide. He also was featured in the films Things Change, Shadows and Fog, and Benny and June. Macy is the resident director of the Atlantic Theater Company. Joining him to perform this very short play by David Mamet is Neil Pepe, artistic director of the company. Here's Macy to introduce it.
Mamet wrote this about how many years ago?
Must have been at least 10 more, probably.
Yeah, Dave lives up in Vermont, and he wrote a collection of Vermont pieces called Vermont Sketches, as a matter of fact. And they're published in one of his books. This one's called Deer Dogs, and it is, in many states, but I know in Vermont, if a dog runs deer, that is, if a dog chases deer, you can shoot the dog, because they have a tendency to run in packs, the dogs, and they'll run a deer to death. And so the law is, you can shoot dogs that run deer, because I guess the dog is supposed to be tied down. So this is Deer Dogs by Buffalo Dave Mamet.
Dogs running deer should be shot.
But who's to tell it's running deer? Law says you see a dog in pursuit of a deer, you can shoot him. Who's to say? Wait, you take Dave here, keeps his dog tied up. One day the dog, say Larry Thompson's dog, is running by. Dave's dog gets loose. Larry's dog's running deer. Someone sees it down the road later on. Larry's dog and Dave's dog. What does he do? Shoot them both.
How did Dave's dog get loose?
I'm saying a dog which is usually tied down, Dave's dog.
How did it get loose?
I'm saying one day when it is loose. I don't know how it got loose.
And was it running deer?
No.
How do you know?
Because it hasn't got a taste for him. It's a tame dog.
Well, how do you know?
Well, now, because it is a tame dog. You know that dog. I know what you're saying, that though the dog is tame, it gets loose, it starts running deer. Is that it?
Yeah.
But what I'm saying, this case, we know that the dog is tame. It's tame. It isn't running deer, all right? It's Dave's dog. It's tame. It's been tied up constantly.
How does it get loose?
Well, say Dave forgot to tie it up.
And where does it go? Where does it go?
I know what you're saying. It goes to the woods. All right.
What is it doing out there?
It's out with Larry Thompson's dog.
What are they doing?
Larry's dog's running deer.
And what is Dave's dog doing?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know either, but I'm going to assume it's running deer.
Would you shoot it?
Yes, I would.
You'd shoot Dave's dog?
Yes, I would.
You'd shoot Dave's dog?
Yes, I would.
Because you know that's the dog that'll be caught. Not Larry Thompson's dog. That's the dog that will be caught. Shoot. It's a bad law. I'm sorry, I don't like it.
Well, you'll like it when you go out in the woods and there ain't no deer.
No, sir. No, sir. Now, I'm going to tell you one more thing. What the law... Wait a second. Now, what the law encourages a fellow to do is... I'm not saying you or me, but what it sets a man up to do is to say, I'm going to shoot that fella's dog. That's not right.
That's great.
That's deer dogs.
That's great. That's William Macy and Neil Pepe. Neil Pepe is the artistic director of the Atlantic Theater Company, and William Macy is the director of the company. I think listening to David Mamet dialogue has made me more aware of the indirect ways that we talk to each other, you know, the way we kind of talk around things almost.
Yes.
I'm wondering, there's so many interruptions and overlaps in the dialogue in not only this play, but in a lot of Mamet writing. How do you rehearse that? How do you rehearse the rhythms with each other?
Well, the main trick is you have to finish the sentences. You have to know what the lines, the words that you don't say, you have to know what they are, or basically what they are. As far as the rhythms go, they're inherent in the writing. They reveal themselves to you when you rehearse the thing. Dave also has this acting technique, which the Atlantic Theater Company is all about, which is called practical aesthetics. And one of the tenets of that technique is that you can't act the words. You can only act the action. You can only figure out what the character, quote-unquote, the character wants in terms of the objective, i.e. what he wants from the other person. And you, through an analytical process, you figure out what that means to you. And that's what you act. Mm-hmm. And the words, essentially, are gibberish. You let them go. Let them come out as they will.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I'm thinking when somebody's talking over you, it's like a little collision in dialogue. And your impulse is to stop. I mean, well, some people go on, somebody else will you don't know whether you should stop or continue, but it's very jarring when it happens. Does that happen to you when you're rehearsing dialogue in which there are those overlaps and interruptions?
Yeah. Yeah. The first couple of times you do it, it's swell for the actor because someone interrupts you and you're it's offensive. It's, well, let me finish. The trick is the 600th time you've done that speech to still be offended when you get interrupted.
Right. To still have it feel abrupt and like a collision.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a great way of putting it, though, a bunch of collisions. It's like several people running down a hallway trying to get to the door at the same time.
Neil, thanks a lot for joining us for the performance part.
Absolutely.
Of the program. Thanks, and good luck with the night of the benefit.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Bill Macy, how did you start working with David Mamet?
I went to a school in Vermont called Goddard College, and David had just graduated, and he came back as, I believe they called him, a teaching fellow, and so he was my teacher. And he taught an acting technique that was roughly Stanislavskian, and more specifically, it was the way Sandy Meisner taught. And he was my teacher, and he was the most outrageous man I'd ever met in my life, and he started writing plays. He came in one day with this collection of short sketches called Sexual Perversity in Chicago. And just about all of us looked at this writing and thought, this is pretty peculiar. This is brand new. And from there, we started a company together called the St. Nicholas Theater. We started it in college, and through a bunch of moves, it ended up in Chicago. And there at the St. Nicholas in Chicago, we did a lot of Dave's first plays and a lot of other people's plays, too, and it was quite successful. And we just hung out together. I presently owe him money, so it ensures my future employment.
If he pays you, you get to pay him back?
Yeah, I think he's going to make sure I keep getting jobs until I pay him off.
So had you been directed by anybody before working with Mamet?
Oh, yeah, I did plays in high school and in college. But what David brought to it, the first thing that he brought to the whole subject of being an actor, which is really what my early college days were about. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew that the only thing I'd ever been successful at or enjoyed was acting. What David brought to it was a sense of pride. He charged us as students to look at the whole thing in a broader sense, what our role in society was and what our responsibilities were. And he did it from a very Russian point of view, a very selfless, either get it together or get out, the world doesn't need you kind of an attitude. And he impressed on us, as Stanislavski said, that the task of the actor was to bring to the stage the life of the human soul, which is a lofty phrase, but he brought it right down to the nitty-gritty. And as a result, he had a work ethic in that class, which has never left me and held me in good stead, and which I've been trying to spread in the community also. Such things as be on time. It sounds like a silly thing, but in David's classes, If you were not on time, which was about 3 minutes before the class was to begin, the door was locked. Don't come in.
Really?
Do not come in.
Were you ever late?
Once or twice.
And you missed it?
Absolutely. And a couple of times it would be after you'd spent all week working on a scene that you were dying to do.
And how was that good discipline?
Well, yeah, about the second time you were late, you decided, perhaps I should not be late anymore. It would be so much easier to be on time than to go through all of this angst.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor and director William H. Macy. He's a co-founder and the director of the Atlantic Theater Company, which has its big annual benefit coming up on June 7th. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Back with William H. Macy, resident director of the Atlantic Theater Company. Now your students have written a book called A Practical Handbook for the Actor, which is based on the style of acting that you and David Mamet teach. In the introduction to the book, Mamet says that most acting is based on shame and guilt. Was that your experience when you were studying acting?
That was my experience when I studied anything in school. It's true. It's particularly bad in the acting profession for a couple of reasons. One, there is such a thing as the muse, and every once in a while, she will visit the actor, and you do the best work you've ever done. And you go back after the performance and say, what was it that allowed me to be that good? And it is indefinable. And so that's a very seductive thing. And what a lot of acting teachers try to do is capture the muse. They try to contain it somehow. And it can't be done. It cannot be done. Sometimes God just visits you and you are wonderful that night. To put your attention on that is folly because it's not controllable. What you can put your attention on is technique. And technique is something that is within your control. And so as Stanislavski said, play well or play badly, but play truthfully. And I think a lot of acting teachers, because they have no technique, because they've never sat down and said, what exactly is the technique, not the art, but the technique of acting, because they've never answered that question for themselves, what they try to teach is feelings. And feelings are so elusive, and emotions, that they end up talking gibberish to the students. And as David says in that introduction, there is a conspiracy. The students will not call the teachers on talking gibberish, and as a result, the teachers will praise the students sometime and damn them others. And generally speaking, with a lot of acting classes, it makes no sense on an intellectual level. It offends your intellect, your intelligence.
Did you study how to use emotional memory for performances, and do you consider that a legit or a gibberish approach?
I did study it briefly, and it's just so much nonsense. It doesn't work.
Explain how it's supposed to work and why it didn't work for you.
Well, the Stanislavski technique broke down into two sections. One was emotional preparation, and the other was the sense of objective, the through line, the action of the piece. Stanislavski invented basically both of those phrases. In the early part of his life, he worked a lot on emotional preparation, which Lee Strasberg was the champion of. And the way it works is, if I'm going to do this piece called Dear Dogs, and I'm playing the character Bunchy, and I'm trying to convince the other character, Larry, that it's wrong to shoot a dog, I would come up with an emotional... I would figure out what the emotional state that Bunchy is in. I would come up with an analogous emotional state that I have been through and put myself into that emotional state, and the speech would then take care of itself. Well, that's foolishness on many levels. One, it's almost impossible to control your emotions, in my opinion. You cannot control your emotions. And to whatever extent you can, it's really outside of any usefulness toward acting. Two, acting, in my opinion, doesn't have anything to do with emotions. And as a matter of fact, they are beside the point. Acting has to do with actions, which brings us to the second half of Stanislavski. And Sandy Meisner at the Neighborhood Playhouse was the great proponent of that. And that is figuring out what the character wants and acting that. In other words, my only job is to get the actor that I'm acting with, in this case it was Neil Pepe, was to get him to change his mind. And it's my job to do that, me personally. William H. Macy, I've got to change Neil Pepe, not some character doing it, because the character doesn't really exist. So I've sort of spun off into the stratosphere on you, but the idea is you can't control your emotions, so leave them outside. They will come or they will not come on their own, and there's nothing you can do about it.
So you don't teach emotional preparation for a theater piece?
No. On the contrary, we say we don't care how you feel about it, and if you really want to know the truth, how you feel about it is relatively boring. I don't know who said it, but boring emotions are fun to indulge in, but tiresome to watch.
What's the most emotion-packed scene that you've had to do in your career?
I don't know. I've died a couple of times, and this play Oleana at the end. I mean, this woman has wrecked his life. But you know, Terry, I thought it was interesting, for me at least. What happened to me over the course of Oleana, which ran for 9 months, was that I consistently found myself going back to that final scene, which is so emotional and so charged, and saying to myself, settle down, cut out all that stuff. Once a week, I would have to go back and say to myself, simplify, simplify, because I would just fall in love with these little emotional turns and explosions that I'd come up with, and I would try to repeat them. And they're just not, they're beside the point.
So what would you be throwing overboard specifically?
Well, you know, one night I would let out some earth-shattering sighs. As a matter of fact, I did that one night, and it was quite a swell moment. I was quite proud of it. But, you know, being the cheap fellow that I am, I tried to do it the following night. And it didn't sound like a sigh. It sounded like I had emphysema, and I think it was just awful. So, you know, like the third night, I finally got it together to say, hey, practice what you preach. Just let that stuff go. There's another rule here, too, which I think many actors fall afoul of, and acting teachers by extension, which is if you cry, the audience won't. If you get upset, the audience won't. What they're doing is having, they're vicariously, they're up on stage with you going through the thing at the same time. That's why we like to watch things. That's why our heart picks up when we're watching TV and the bad guys are right around the corner and the good guy's walking right into a trap. Your heart's pounding because you're there. You're part of the thing. Well, if the actors pump up the emotion and essentially tell the audience everything that they're supposed to be feeling, it robs them of the experience. Much better, play it close to the chest and don't let all of that stuff out, except the stuff that will come out whether you want it to or not.
Right.
And the audience will get more bang for their buck.
I get the feeling with someone like you that you'd be a good actor no matter what technique you were using. Do you know what I mean? That even technique only goes so far, and that you're someone who's going to be a good actor one way or another. And that if a bad actor were using this technique, maybe they'd be a bad actor one way or another. What do you think?
Yes, I think technique cannot make you an actor, but it can make a good actor a better actor, and
yeah,
it can make a bad actor a competent actor.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me that everybody can act a role or two. If you're going to be a professional actor, you've got to be able to act more than roles than that, or you're not going to be able to make a living. But the idea of being simple and truthful on stage, anybody can learn to do it. And so, theoretically, everybody could play a role or two.
Now, you have your own theater that you co-founded in 1983, the Atlantic Theater Company.
I'm the godfather. It's not really my theater.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I didn't mean it to sound quite that possessive.
Right.
But what are the advantages to you of having a home base like that and not being completely dependent on other people's theater companies and other people's movies?
A sense of community and a sense of home, and you know, I've been doing more films. That's what I'm trying to do. I've been on the road now for 2 years, so it's really swell to go over to the Atlantic Theater Company on 20th Street, and I walk in and I know everybody, and my picture's on the wall, and I can borrow a buck to get a Coke and, you know, take a nap on the couch if it's not already full, which it usually is. They teach classes at Atlantic, so generally speaking, the place is packed with students doing what this game called a repetition exercise, which makes you think like you've walked into Bellevue when you... It's odd.
Well, now I have to find out what the repetition exercise is.
Well, you're supposed to... The big thing is to be in the moment when you're on stage. So it's this game that Sandy Meisner made up that is about being in the moment, and you simply repeat until something happens to make you change. I won't bore you with the details, but it looks like this. It sounds like this. You've got on a green shirt. I've got on a green shirt. You've got on a green shirt. I've got on a green shirt. You've got on a green shirt. I've got on a green shirt. You're boring. I'm boring. You're boring. I'm boring. So you see these two people doing this all over in every corner of the theater. Outsiders think,
And you find that useful?
Yes. It's a fabulous game. The idea of taking your attention off of yourself when there are 1,300 people watching you is quite a trick. The only people who... You know who else has a rough time with that? Boxers. The idea of taking your attention off of yourself when there's a 6'3" man who's been training all his life to knock your head off, to take your attention off of that and put it on knocking his head off, that takes guts. And I think it's analogous, the kind of guts that an actor has to have, to stand in front of those people and get your attention off of yourself and put it somewhere else.
What's it like for you when you do an audition for a movie and you get your time with the casting director, with the director, and you have a limited amount of time to make a good impression?
It's your worst nightmare. It's, you know those nightmares you have when you wake up and you say, whew, thank God I was only dreaming. Well, it's like that, except you weren't dreaming. It was real.
Right.
It's a hideous thing. It's hideous, particularly when it's a great role for you and you know you could just kick it to no end. And you've got to prove yourself to those people. And I happen to be rotten at it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good at it at all.
What goes wrong for you at those auditions?
Oh, I have a tendency to get angry when I have to audition. And so, because I can't be angry, I end up being ironic and saying funny things that aren't that funny and are generally very insulting. They flew me out to L.A. one time for a series, and it had come down to me. I thought I had negotiated the money, which was more money than Canada takes in yearly. I thought my life was made. So they fly me out to L.A., didn't tell me anything. I walk into this room. There are three guys that are identical to me sitting there looking like they're going to explode from nervousness. And it turns out... I didn't know the gig, but there are four of us for this role, and then there are four other roles that each have four people. All these people sitting in a room. I mean, you could have, if you could have figured out how to harness that energy, you could have run L.A. For a month on the energy of these people just sitting there sweating. And then one at a time, everybody goes into this giant room that had a 16-foot table with all these suits sitting at it, off in the dark, and in this lighted space, you get up and you do your thing. And they decide whether you're going to be rich for the next 5 years and perhaps a movie star for the rest of your life or whether you're going to just get back on the airplane. Well, I freaked out. I walked into the room. I looked at these people. My hand to God, I looked at them and I said, would those of you who are important stand up? Well, that was that. They didn't crack a smile. So I went through and I did my audition, but yo, boy.
Oh, wow. Did you know you were going to say that?
No, I just knew that I was furious. It's so inhuman.
Well, Bill Macy, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
William H. Macy is the co-founder and artistic director of the Atlantic Theater Company. Their annual benefit, June 7th in New York, will feature very, very short plays performed by Macy, Giancarlo Esposito, Treat Williams, Griffin Dunn, and Eric Stoltz. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The movie Super Mario Brothers opened today. It's based on a video game, a game that made super profits for the Nintendo company. The only thing that grossed more in the entertainment field was the film E.T. Coming up, we'll talk about the video game industry with David Sheff, author of a new book about Nintendo. And TV critic David Bianculli says NBC has prematurely pulled the plug on a lot of its good dramatic and comedy series. Now they're tripping up a new series before it even airs. David previews the latest creation of Jay Tarsis, the creator of Buffalo Bill and the Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Orlando, Florida, a jury in a retrial of a Miami police officer has acquitted him in connection with the 1989 deaths of two black men in Miami. Doug Phillips reports from Orlando.
When the verdict was announced, Officer William Lozano hugged his defense lawyers and then his family. In his first public comments to reporters since his retrial began, the Colombian-born Lozano said his legal saga took its toll, but is now over.
We all know, and the community knows, that I have worked very hard in festivals, doing every way I could to try to raise money to so we can be able to pay and finally justice prevail.
Jurors cleared Lozano for the 1989 death of a black motorcyclist and his passenger in Miami's Overtown neighborhood. A Miami jury convicted Lozano, but an appellate court overturned the verdicts, saying the trial shouldn't have been held in Miami because jurors there feared that acquitting Lozano would cause racial unrest. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Orlando.
President Clinton traveled to Philadelphia today to continue his efforts to gain support for his economic plan, and he called last night's approval in the House an end to hot air and gridlock in the nation's capital. Mr. Clinton called on thousands of people at an outdoor rally at City Hall to support his plan of spending cuts and tax increases aimed at cutting the nation's deficit. Last night's slim victory in the House indicates how tough the battle will be in the Senate. A half-dozen conservative Democrats in the Senate have indicated their opposition to higher energy taxes. Attempts to make Sarajevo a safe area failed today when the Bosnian Serb commander pulled out of talks in the Bosnian capital. The United States, Europe, and Russia are supporting establishment of safe havens in Bosnia to protect Muslim residents there. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Zagreb.
While the Muslim-led Bosnian government and the Croats of Bosnia agreed on withdrawal lines in the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo, the Bosnian Serb general refused to join the talks. General Ratko Mladic pulled out of the military meeting as Bosnian Serb artillery and mortar fire fell near the city center. The meeting today was arranged by UN Commander General Philip Morion to prod the three warring sides into agreements on demilitarizing the city. It's the first step in ending the siege of the Bosnian capital. The Bosnian Serb commander said he boycotted the talks because he was unhappy over arrangements for so-called safe areas in two other Bosnian towns, Zepa and Srebrenica. The Bosnian Serb general says that the Muslim defenders of these cities have not turned in their weapons. It's one of the conditions of establishing the zones to protect predominantly Muslim populations. In Zagreb, this is Deborah Amos.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 27 points to close at 3,527.43. on volume of more than 207 million shares. This is NPR News. One day after a bomb explosion killed at least five people and destroyed valuable artworks, nearly 100,000 people demonstrated in Florence, Italy. In other major cities across Italy, residents took to the streets to protest the bombing. A government minister says the likely suspect for this explosion and one in Rome 2 weeks ago is the mafia. But other officials say it could be terrorists trying to profit from unrest in the country. As expected, President Clinton has renewed China's most favorable nation trade status for one more year, but warned that it will not be renewed in the future unless human rights improve in China. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
In an executive order today, the president says MFN will not be renewed next year unless China treats political prisoners more humanely, allows free emigration, and protects the culture of Tibet, among other conditions. He also says China must stop exporting dangerous missile technology and must make trade concessions, but does not tie these demands to most favored nation status. It's left to the Secretary of State to determine whether China has met the human rights conditions, which gives the administration some flexibility in deciding whether to renew China's favorable trade status. The president must navigate through the conflicting demands of Congress, which wants strict conditions, and U.S. business interests, which want no conditions at all, fearing that China will close its vast market to American firms if MFN is revoked. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher says that he expects the U.N. Security Council to act by sometime next week on a plan to create Muslim safe havens in Bosnia. Five nations, including the U.S., have proposed setting up six protected areas now and more later for people forced out of their homes in Bosnia. Christopher has conceded that he has mixed ideas on the proposal. Safe areas are a part of a plan approved last week by the U.S., Spain, Britain, France, and Russia. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Movies and TV shows have been turned into video games, but now a video game has become a film, Super Mario Brothers. I guess that's no surprise, considering one of the Mario games grossed over $500 million. The game's manufacturer, the Japanese Nintendo Company, made more profits from video game sales last year than the profits of all the movie studios combined. My guest David Sheff is the author of the new book, Game Over, How Nintendo Zapped an American Industry, Captured Your Dollars, and Enslaved Your Children. Now Nintendo is branching out into computer networks and virtual reality. Sheff decided to write his book after reading a survey that indicated more kids recognized Super Mario than Mickey Mouse.
There were Super Mario Saturday morning cartoons and after-school cartoons and Super Mario breakfast cereals and bed sheets and all kinds of things like that, and all the other, everything else that came along, whether it was Batman or whether it was The Simpsons, they became Nintendo games. And then I started to hear teachers at not only my son's school, but at other schools that some friends of mine who just were also seeing that this thing was sort of becoming this, it was a sub-cult. And someone mentioned to me that the fact that while this was so pervasive, most adults didn't have a clue. And she's the one who first said the word. She talked about how we had grown up as a generation completely influenced by television. And what no one has caught on to yet is that there is a new generation emerging, which she called the Nintendo generation. Kids who are being more influenced by electronic games and by interactive electronic entertainments than by television, or at least being influenced in a new and profound way.
I think it'd be interesting to hear the history of a couple of the big video games. Why don't you tell us the story of Donkey Kong, which eventually led to the creation of Super Mario Brothers? Yeah.
Donkey Kong was designed by accident. Nintendo was a thriving company in Japan, and the son-in-law of the chairman was sent over to America to conquer the U.S. market as well. And there was a game that was sent over to America that was supposed to be their first big product, and it was a disaster. Kids hated it. And so the president of the Nintendo company in America pled with his father-in-law, Hiroshi Yamauchi, in Japan to send him a better game. But Yamauchi had all of his great top engineers working on other projects, and so he didn't have time to deal with it. So just to placate his son-in-law, he called in this man who was an artist. He had no experience in computers. He was not an engineer. He was hired only because his father was a friend of the chairman's, and they figured that they would have him paint some boxes of for video games and some advertisements and things like that. His name was Sugiro Miyamoto. And because he was not a traditional computer nerd, he had no experience in video games and no experience in computers, he came at it from a completely different approach. And instead of trying to figure out what he could do with the limited technology, he asked a lot of questions. Why are all the games the same? Why are it's all about pushing a button and shooting something and then the thing gets destroyed? Why can't the games do more? Why can't the games tell stories? And he came up with all these fun characters from his notebook. As an artist, he came up with this funny gorilla and this carpenter wearing suspenders and a hat, intentionally trying to find an atypical hero, sort of a pudgy guy with he described him kind of as a Walter Mitty character, not necessarily somebody that we would normally think of as the hero of a video game. And he put this thing together and named it Donkey Kong. And when it was sent over from Japan to the American company, supposedly to save them, they were appalled. In fact, one of the engineers, one of the salespeople was so appalled that he quit. This was a time when all the games had names like Annihilate and Destroy and Kill and Murder. And here was a game that had come over from Japan that didn't involve any shooting, and it was called Donkey Kong. And these guys, they just thought it was a disaster. But Yamauchi, the chairman, told them to try to sell it, and it brought in Nintendo's first couple hundred million dollars.
The way you describe it, Nintendo's strategy in terms of the marketing was to be willing to not make a lot of money on selling the hardware so that people would buy the Nintendo system, and then to really make a killing selling the software that you
need
Nintendo system for.
Yeah, and it's pretty, I mean, any parent with a persuasive child will tell you that that's exactly what happens. They might be convinced one Christmas after resisting for, depending on how strong-willed the parent is, maybe resisting for a while, but normally people succumb. Now there are about 35 million Nintendo systems in American homes. More than one out of every three homes has one. So they'll buy the system, and now it costs about $100, which is a lot for a toy for a child, but that's just the beginning. What Nintendo knows is that once you've bought that system, that you, over the life of the system, until the next one comes along, so we're talking about in the course of about 3 or 4 years, a family will probably buy an average, the average of 10 or 11 games. Those games are each $40, $50. The new ones are about $70. So we're talking about an enormous investment. I mean, I don't know when, in what other time or in what other field, children are able to account for so much of a family's spending.
My guest is David Sheff, author of the new book, Game Over. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Sheff, author of a new book about Nintendo. The Nintendo hardware has been called by some a Trojan horse. Why?
Yeah. Just like the Trojan horse, there's something hidden inside the Nintendo system. I think a lot of adults would be surprised that if you pick up the video game system, the plastic box that's hooked up to the TV set, there's a panel on the bottom. And when you remove that panel, there is a port there, just like a port on the back of a computer. And it basically is saying the obvious, which is that the Nintendo system, even though it's considered a toy and a sort of an entertainment system for kids, is really a computer in disguise. Nintendo has plans to sell us peripherals that will make the Nintendo system do a lot more than just play games. In Japan, they've already released the Nintendo Network, and so children there can play games. A kid in Kyoto can play a game simultaneously against a kid in Tokyo. That's going to be expanded so that we'll be able to do that with every place around the world, pretty much. All over the United States, children will be playing games against one another and also against kids in Europe and in Japan. So Nintendo has come out with this system that has the potential to do all these things. And the reason it's really important is as companies are going to be coming out, we all hearing a lot of talk about the new multimedia industry and when videos, home movies are going to come out either on CDs or else over telephone lines, and we're going to be able to do our shopping over with the television set and order pizzas and play the stock market and do banking and all those kinds of things. There's a lot of companies that are going to come in and try to sell a product that will do that, and it'll probably cost $500 or $600. Well, Nintendo is going to then be able to come out with something that will just, you'll buy $100. For $100, you'll be able to hook it onto the system that you've already got because your kids are playing it. And they have a big advantage in the future, in this future industry, and they have a good chance of taking a big chunk of it.
Let's get back to the video games of the present. This week it was announced that Sega, one of the video games company, would start rating its videos, rating them for different age groups so that parents could determine if there was violence that they didn't want their children to be exposed to in a video game and so on. What are the more controversial games now in terms of sex and violence?
The video games have gone from these sort of magical, you know, sort of wonderlands to pretty repulsive stuff. The biggest selling video game last year was called Street Fighter II, and in it you got to choose your character, and you chose from a gallery of about 6 or 8 of the most repulsive creatures you've ever seen. And these guys just basically beat each other up for as long as you can sit in front of the screen. And if you get really good at it, as a lot of 12 and 10-year-olds can show you, you can get your guy to jump on his opponent, grab him around the neck, and start biting his skull until blood spurts out. The game that is really controversial now is called Mortal Kombat. And it's a martial arts game, and it's got two guys, again, beating each other up. And the violence is just getting more extreme, and the graphics are getting better, which means it's more realistic. At the end of the game, if you win, if you beat up the other guy, that's not enough. You were told, finish him off, which I think is a pretty interesting message to give to kids. But you're told to finish him off, and then you have a choice. There's a sort of a menu of different ways you can finish him off. And some of the better ones are you can reach your hand into your opponent's chest and pull out his heart, which is still beating. Or you can rip off his, you can pull his head off of his shoulders and have so his spine is sort of jangling there. The irony of Sega coming out and saying that they want to rate video games is that their games are far more brutal and violent than any other companies. And to me, it's a smokescreen. They're basically trying to placate critics. The reason that the games are getting so violent is because now the industry has gotten so big that it's so expensive to create a game that imaginative kind of, you know, wonderful games that someone might come up with are too risky for companies to bet all their millions of dollars on. And so what they do is they do just what happens in, you know, other entertainment forms, certainly in movies. And they go with the easy sells, which is, the kids will respond if you give them violence, and so it seems like the video game designers are in a battle to see who can come up with, bloodier, more gruesome ways to do violence.
You're a parent of a 9-year-old?
He's 10 now, yeah.
He's 10 now, okay. So do you control the video games that he watches and the amount of time that he watches, that he interacts with?
Yeah.
And do you have any say in which video games get let into the house and which ones you think are either too violent or too sexist or whatever?
Definitely. At first I didn't. And then I started paying more attention. And I realized that, first of all, as far as the content is concerned, I don't want my son sitting in front of a screen. First of all, I don't want him sitting in front of a screen that much anyway, but when he is sitting in front of a screen, I don't want him to be wasting his time pushing a button as fast as he can, and so that he won't be murdered, which is really what the bottom line is to a lot of these games. So I definitely get involved in the games. I mean, there's a game called, for instance, Mario Paint, which is it's magical. I mean, it's basically you can create characters, you can animate them, and you can score them with everything from trumpets and drums to pig snorts, and it's fabulous. I only let him play a half an hour a day, which makes me very unpopular. His friends, he always used to like to come over our house to spend the night, but they don't want to come over anymore because they want to sit there and play. And when I tell him finally his half hour is over, he'll get furious with me and he'll throw himself on the floor and he'll roll around and he'll tell me that I'm the worst parent on the planet. But then 10 minutes later, he's doing something else. He's drawing or he's building something or he's outside playing with a puppy or climbing in a tree or something like that. One thing that's pretty interesting is that I was thinking about this. There's an old story about people of the generation of parents of these kids, of these video game addicted kids. When we were kids, after school we'd go outside and we'd play and we'd go down to the park and we'd hang out with our friends until we were called in for dinner. These kids, especially kids in urban centers, but even in suburban places a lot around this country, are never allowed to play outside on their own. It's a whole new world out there. Parents are too scared that something's going to happen to their kids. And so maybe this sort of new form of entertainment, this sort of bringing in all these sports games, for instance, into the living room, so kids are playing football and baseball while they're sitting in front of the TV set and playing all these video games, maybe it's a reflection of something that's going on in the culture. Maybe it's not saying it's a good thing, but maybe it's a response in a way to the fact that kids just can't be outside on their own.
I'm going to end on a note that's, this is so stupid, perhaps only someone who's never played Super Mario Brothers, could ask, but what does it mean? Are the Mario Brothers super? Are their last names Mario, so they're like the Gross Sisters or the Mario Brothers? I mean, am I missing something?
No, it's a good question. It makes no sense at all. Mario and Luigi are the brothers. I don't even know if they have a last name. All they did was they came up with Mario. Mario was a big hit. Kids loved him. And so that the programmers could differentiate a partner for him so that there could be two players at one time, they came up with a guy who, while Mario is short and fat, his brother, Luigi, is tall and thin, and one of them's wearing red suspenders and the other one's wearing green suspenders. There's no reason for it at all. There's a fun, the reason that they have hats is because the programmers in Japan couldn't figure out a way to deal with the inertia that way. If a character would jump on the video game screen and he would be falling down, his hair would fly up. The reason they have hats is because they didn't want to deal with the flying hair.
Yeah, but the hat could have fallen off. Do the hats have chin straps?
Yes, it does. Yes, these hats are glued on.
David Sheff is the author of the new book, Game Over. Lester Bowie playing James Brown on Fresh Air. The Lozano verdict came in today. Linda Wertheimer, what will we have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll have a report from Orlando where the trial was, and we'll look to the city of Miami for some reaction, Terry. We'll also have a report on the mayoral race coming up in Los Angeles. The economy looks a little bit weaker in reports today. We'll talk about that. We'll see if what the White House is going to do now that they got a very slender margin victory, but a victory on the economic plan. Apparently, they're going to take the ball and walk very carefully with it. We'll also talk to a congressman from Pennsylvania, a Democrat who voted against the president. He'll explain why he did that to one of his constituents.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This weekend, NBC premieres a new weekly series, a mystery comedy from Jay Tarsis, the creator of Buffalo Bill and The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. Up until last week, the new show was titled Smoldering Lust. Now it's got a new name, a terrible time slot, and it's our TV critic David Bianculli who's smoldering.
It's bad enough that the network's just killed a lot of terrific young shows. I'll Fly Away, Brooklyn Bridge, The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, Flying Blind, The Ben Stiller Show, Civil Wars. But they're not content with that form of TV brutality anymore. Now they've found a way to develop a good new series and kill it before it even gets started. Why? I have no idea. But I also have no idea why Jay Tarsis went back to NBC in the first place, after the dismal way they treated Buffalo Bill and Molly Dodd. Yet he agreed to make 13 episodes of a new comedy series for NBC. And he did. He finished them almost 6 months ago and turned them in, and NBC has kept them on the shelf until this weekend, Memorial Day weekend. Tarsis called the series Smoldering Lust. It stars Bradley Whitford as Dave Brodsky, a guy who's a part-time private eye and part-time owner of a shop that locates and sells rare LP records. As the series opens, he's working for Margot Cody, the wife of a clothes catalog bigwig who suspects her husband of having an affair. She's played by Kate Capshaw, who's given a lot more here to work with than when she co-starred in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. The scenes between Whitford and Capshaw are both steamy and funny, like an old Howard Hawks movie.
Brodsky, Cody, and me, we were so much in love.
Yeah, I know. So now you're hurt, angry, vulnerable, and dangerous. Margo, you're so mercurial. You're up, you're down, you're hot, you're cold, you hate him, you love him, hit me, kiss me. Baby, get consistent.
Shut up. And do your dirty little job. Going back to the party.
Fix your makeup.
Wipe the lipstick off your mouth.
Straighten your dress.
Kiss me.
Okay.
don't touch me.
I'm out of here.
This is a really delightful series. No laugh track, solid plot, and lots of clever performances. But NBC is making sure this series, which premieres tomorrow night, is dead on arrival. It's launching the show on this holiday weekend, one of the lowest viewing periods of the year. It's taking a serial storyline and sticking it on Saturday night, where even the show's fans might not be able to commit to it regularly. Remember how well that trick worked for China Beach and Twin Peaks? And then, as a final blow, it changes the name of the show from Smoldering Lust, which is clever, to Black Tie Affair, which makes no sense whatsoever. When a network treats a new show like this at the start, you can be sure the show is being written off and never will be renewed. So why should viewers work hard to overcome these obstacles and watch Smoldering Lust, or whatever it's called, and become involved with characters they know will disappear around Labor Day? Tough question. My only answer is that it's a good show. And with the networks throwing out their quality series left and right, good shows are getting harder and harder to find. I'll leave you with that thought, and with this music. It's the original theme song to Smoldering Lust, which had to be jettisoned when NBC demanded a title change. You heard it here first and last.
Smoldering lust, a moth around a flame, desire in a shameless heart. Smoldering lust, a sad, deadly sin, when skin
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Jill Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross, and all of us at Fresh Air wish you a good holiday weekend.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The musical She Loves Me is being revived on Broadway. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from lyricist Sheldon Harnick. His other musicals include Fiddler on the Roof and Fiorello. Also, an interview with Kenneth Branagh, the director and star of the new film adaptation of Much Ado About Nothing. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.